In the childcare consortium, one of our kind of key interests has been in children's access and participation in early childhood education and care. And this is an issue that is very much on the political agenda in Finland at the present. The political measures in Finland address especially five-year-old children. But what is discussed and what is going on in the discussions about participation in early childhood education in your home countries and internationally in general? Could you, Rianne, start and tell us something a little bit about what's the situation in Canada?
Okay, well, Finland's participation rate, not surprisingly, is so much better than Canada's. Although there's considerable variation amongst the provinces of Canada, there are just over one quarter of all children 0 to 5 who have part-time or full-time places in regulated childcare. Despite an employment rate, at least pre-COVID, of 72% of mothers 0 to 2 and 78% of mothers 3 to 5. So there's a kind of a disconnect between what we have available in terms of regulated early learning and childcare for children and actually at least parental need, let alone the children's needs. There seems to be greater consensus, however, on provision for five-year-olds, as most provinces offer kindergarten through the public school system, and there's an increasing emphasis on including four-year-olds in part or full-day kindergarten. So that's the situation currently, but COVID-19, which we understand here as a she session, a recession that has hit women particularly hard, has helped to fuel a strong pan-Canadian initiative aimed at making early learning and childcare universally available, affordable, high quality, and inclusive. So we're expecting an announcement on Monday when the federal budget is released, which will begin to change things in my country. Thank you.
That's really, in a way, interesting to hear this, that what the COVID-19 has entailed in the sense of kind of developing early childhood education and care in Canada. But it was also surprising that the participation numbers that they are quite low compared to like when in Finland we have this for example 3-year-olds about 84.5% are in early childhood education and care. But then, would you, Michelle, like to continue and add about the situation in Belgium and in Europe?
Okay. Well, indeed, it's interesting to see that Europe, and especially the European Commission, has started to get more interest in the participation of children in early childhood education, not only from a gender equality and an employment perspective, but more so from an educational perspective. And that's why in 2015, the European Parliament called on the European Commission and on the European Member States to introduce what they call a child guarantee, to ensure that every child in poverty can have access to a number of issues: free healthcare, free education, free childcare, decent housing, and adequate nutrition. And it launched a campaign in 3 phases. And just 2 weeks ago, the second phase was finished, which means that a report was presented that, amongst other issues in that report, it was analyzed what are the problems for the access to childcare for children at risk of poverty and what are possible solutions and how and what are also the costs and benefits of investing in access for children in poverty. From the report, we can see that it is very difficult to say something about Europe as a whole, because there are huge differences, not only in the overall enrollment, but also in the inequality of enrollment of children. So we have heard figures now from Finland and from Canada, but of course it's important not only to see what is the percentage of children that have access, but also who are these children and who are the ones who do not have access. What we see in general is that countries in Europe with high levels of enrollment, higher than the European average, are also countries with lower inequality, lower than the European average, and vice versa. But there are some notable exceptions. Belgium, my country, is an exception, together with France and the Netherlands, where we have a strange combination of high overall enrollment for the youngest children between 0 and 3. It is between 50% and 60% in Belgium, combined with very high inequality. Okay? So we see that in Belgium, for instance, children from dual income families with, let's say, above average income, 80 and even a bit more than 80% of the children are enrolled in childcare, while children in poverty, and that is very often also children from migrant families, there only 30% are, and 30 to 40, depending on how we define them, are enrolled. So we have an inequality index of 2, meaning that children from the higher end of the social scale are twice as much enrolled than children from the lower end. France has an inequality index of 3. So, but there are big differences within Europe. I will leave it to that for the moment. We can continue that discussion later.
Thank you, Michel. The question of children at the risk of poverty is in a way, or is interesting also when I think about the work we have done in the childcare project. For example, when we analyzed interviews with municipal politicians, one issue that struck us was, for example, the fact that when we discussed the access to early childhood education and care, so basically, or which every child has, especially looked at what or which are the families or parents that are somehow talked as problematic in one way or another in relation to their access. So there were only very few politicians or a few politicians that mentioned or referred to the possibility that families, the services would be important because the families basically live in poverty. What would you say, Jorma? I know that you have studied the history and of Finnish early childhood education and daycare. Has the topic of poverty been or in which ways has it been discussed, or has it been discussed in Finland and related to daycare and early childhood education?
Well, Finland is one of the very few countries where actually there are alternatives between care, education and money. And if there are such alternatives, so of course, poor families are more interested in money. Perhaps they have less need of care or education. So there is a margin in Finland where still families with small children or even children after 3 years age, if they have smaller sisters or brothers, so the parents can choose money instead of taking care or education. And of course, people consider the situation from the viewpoint of home. So are there reasons why to let the child go to care or education when the child is smaller? So the reasons are probably also smaller. And when the child gets to educational age, so most people in Finland tend to think that there is something important and good if the children take part in education. But if they have to select between money and education, so it's very, very much understandable that some of them choose money.
Thank you. I think we'll get back to this money issue a little bit later. One of the topics in participation in early childhood education and care are the immigrant children. Finland is still a country where the number of the immigrants is low in comparison to many other, for example, European countries. And by us, most of the immigrants live in the big cities or towns. So, okay, this is in a way a personal kind of observation, but I think that the discussion about immigrant children and their participation in early childhood education and care is kind of emerging and has increased also in Finland. I know that, for example, in Belgium, the situation regarding immigrant families is very, very different from ours. So would you, Michelle, tell a little bit about what is going on and what type of issues or police measures has been taken in Belgium regarding immigrant children and early childhood education and care? And I think Canada also is very different from us. So then if also you comment on this topic, then Brianne.
There's two things I would like to say about this subject. One is that the concern about the enrollment of migrant children, we have to be careful about the amalgam between migrant origin and social class. Why I say that is, from a European perspective, there is not so much a concern about the inequality of enrollment or the low enrollment of migrant children, as I have just explained in the Child Guarantee Project and in the next years between now and 2030, a lot of European money will be dedicated to tackle these inequalities, especially in the countries where enrollment is low. But it is about children in poverty, not about migrant children. And I think it is an important distinction. It is an important distinction because we have to be careful not to culturalize issues that are in fact issues of class. Because we know that a lot of migrant families are also poor families, but the problem is not that they are migrant, the problem is that they are poor, and we should not mingle these two things. Why I say that is because there is a very interesting study, a study of Wim van Lancker, colleague from Leuven University, together with international colleagues, and they have looked at different European countries and different OECD countries, and looked at this question, as it is often assumed that migrant children are less often enrolled for cultural reasons, because it is not in their culture, and it could be in their culture that motherly care is important in the first years, and this kind of reasoning that culture, so assuming that culture is the barrier. And what they have compared countries with on the basis of EU SILIC data, where you could rank countries in the degree to which they have a culture where it is more assumed that mothers take care of their children at the younger stage, and countries where it is more generally accepted that there is equality on the labor market from an early age on. And what we see is that in countries where there is a culture of maternal care for the youngest children, there is low overall enrollment of children in early childhood education, but not so much inequality. It's just low overall enrollment. High inequality is not linked to culture, but is much more linked to structural barriers. Structural barriers such as affordability, availability, and geographical disparities. So I think that is an important distinction we need to make, and we have to look to ask really this important question: if there is a low enrollment of migrant children, and there is a concern about that, is it really related to the migrant status? Why do we think it is related to the migrant status? And is it not an issue just of class and poverty? And okay. Now, having said that, that does not necessarily mean that there is not an issue about migrant children. It's just to say that we have to distinguish the two. And there might be an issue about migrant children. And this is especially the case for some groups of migrants. And I think if you look at it from a European perspective, in all the 27 European member states, then this is especially the case for Roma children. These are the children who are most underrepresented in early childhood education in all European countries. There have been some interesting experiments and in especially Central European countries, amongst others in Slovenia and in Bulgaria. And especially in Bulgaria, there was a very interesting experiment that was funded by the World Bank, in which in different cities where you have important Roma settlements, different initiatives were taken to enhance the enrollment of Roma children. Among these interventions was, among others, was giving more information to parents about the importance of early childhood education, was also financial incentives, and different combinations. And what they showed was that the most important thing that had the most effect were the financial incentives. And the reason is that even when early childhood education is free, there are always indirect costs, like you need to pay the bus to go there, or you need to have good shoes to go there. There's a lot of material indirect costs, and that is often one of the challenges. But also, what was also very important was that you have bridging figures that can make the bridge between the family cultures and the institutional cultures. So the having Roma assistance, for instance, was very important, not only to talk to the parents, but also to talk to the teachers, because what the experiments showed in both in Bulgaria and in Slovenia is that when teachers who work in early childhood education need support to work with the cultural increasing cultural diversity. It, very often we see that in the curriculum in the pre-service training, dealing with diversity is an undervalued subject, and especially dialoguing with having parent participation and two-way dialogues with parents from diverse origins is something that teachers are ill-prepared to. And that is really the role of these Roma assistants or other people from migrant descent, that they can support the teachers in this two-way dialogue with parents. And that is one of the one of the more salient reasons that are really related to the migrant status of the children that can explain the inequality of enrollment. So basically what I wanted to bring in the debate is, let's be careful that we do not mingle cultural issues with economic issues, because they are not the same. But that is not to say that there's not cultural issues, and that one of the problems of early childhood education is that we have a staff that is too wide, or much wider than the audience that we serve, and that it, that is one of the reasons why the dialogue with parents is not always working very well, and the dialogue of parents is really the gatekeeper for the enrollment of children.
I can pick up very much on the kind of themes that Michelle's explored in two different ways. First of all, Canada is a country of immigration. And if you go to cities like Toronto, Vancouver, Montreal, I would say probably over half the population has at least one parent who was born elsewhere. So I thought, wow, this is really a good question. Let me see what's happening. And I found out there we do have one program, which is for newcomers to Canada who are taking classes in the official language and one of the two official languages, French or English. And there's a program for their children, free child care throughout that. But there's nothing else specifically oriented to immigrant children. So I got in touch with the person who knows the most about Canadian child care, and she said, there's almost no research on this issue. Why? Well, precisely, actually, the point that Michelle is making is that for the most part, the issue arises under the cover of class and the way in which class comes together with race and ethnicity. And that's been really, we've been aware of it for quite some time, but COVID has really brought out the way in which poverty and racial ethnic characteristics really combined. So in Toronto, for example, the areas worst hit are the people working in warehouses and other kinds of necessary jobs where they cannot afford to work from home, like a lot of middle-class professionals. So those are the areas that tend to be poor and tend to have also, unfortunately, the least provision of high-quality care. Now, there are efforts. Toronto certainly has made an effort in cultural terms to stress diversity in its programming, and also has an active anti-poverty program working on poverty by postal code. So certain areas where we know more people who are poor and who also happen to be often from other countries originally. That's one part of my story, but to pick up in a sense on a different something different from the Roma question, but one which may have some resonance in Finland, is the question of Indigenous people in Canada. They only count for about 4.6% of the total population, but in some provinces, such as Manitoba, they account for 18% of the population and nearly 30% of the children 0 to 4. So they're quite an important group, and historically they've been terribly disadvantaged. We have the stain on our history, very much almost like South African apartheid, we took children and put them in residential schools, ripped them away from their families, their languages, and their culture. This began to be resisted, particularly in the 1990s, but the first forms of addressing this were very, what I would consider paternalistic, with kind of using the Aboriginal Head Start program. So we come in and we provide a richness to you, which you don't have, which very much goes against the kind of view of the child that Peter Moss is always talking about, which is all children are rich children. Now it's changed. And I'm sounding a little bit too optimistic, but there's a whole new Indigenous early learning and childcare framework, which is going to deliver quality early learning childcare by Indigenous people and rooted in Indigenous cultures, knowledges, and languages. And I think that's a huge step forward. I don't know if this has any resonance in terms of Finland and the Sami community.
So then still one issue related to early childhood education and care, and something that in a way, I think in the Finnish early childhood education and care, we don't really kind of pay attention to or discuss is the system itself. So we have an integrated system, and this early childhood education and care, so it provides childcare for families to enable parents to work, and then also early childhood education and care for children, and kind of addressing children's well-being and learning. But in this is not the system that all countries have. So there are these split systems where childcare and early childhood education are separated systems and fields. I think I address this question especially to Michelle, but so how do you see the benefits and challenges of an integrated and split service system?
Well, to be honest, I am a bit jealous of you having this integrated system, because I live and work in a country with a split system. And just recently, over the last 2 months, I had a series of discussions with colleagues in France, Italy, and the Netherlands, where we all share this split system exactly about this issue. And we have inventorized a series of common challenges that we all face in Belgium, in France, in the Netherlands, and in Italy regarding the split system. So I will maybe first give a very brief overview of what are the challenges, and then finally also give maybe one challenge or one question that I have about the integrated system. But first, for the split system, one of the typicalities of split systems is that the access is unequal between the youngest children and the older children. Almost all split systems have a long history, sometimes of more than a century, a very long history where the older children are in a system that is supposed to be education and that is related to school, and therefore is assumed to be universal and an entitlement for all children. In most countries, it is an entitlement. In some countries, such as in France for the moment, it will become even compulsory from the age of 3 years on, while the system for the youngest children is more related to employment, to maternal employment, and therefore much less universal. So there is a lot of discussion about inequality of access, as we discussed it previously in this small seminar, but for the youngest children, that is not there for the oldest children. Second, in split system, you all see in all split systems that the staff that works with the youngest children has the lowest qualifications, has less access to continuous professional development, and has worse working conditions and lower salaries, for instance. So that's another issue. There is also an issue of financing by the state and subsidies. Subsidies are per child are lower for the youngest children than for the oldest children in split systems. From the perspective of the child, we see that there is, of course, in split systems, there is one more transition. You not only have the transition from home to childcare, but also from childcare to preschool. And what we see is that these different institutions, childcare and preschool, the youngest and the oldest early childhood children, these two institutions have a very different culture, different adult-child ratios, different ways of looking at children, different conceptions of what is a child that needs to be cared for, a child that is a learner. And that this is for some children a difficult transition. But moreover, we see that increasingly people in the preschool, staff of the preschool, assume that children have been to childcare before and that is for them the transition is easy. But there is an inequality in this access to childcare, which means that the children who have not been enrolled in childcare enroll directly in preschool when they are 3 years of age, and for them and that are mostly children, either from migrant backgrounds and or children in poverty, for them that transition can be quite challenging. And we have seen in longitudinal studies that that may influence later school dropouts also. So that is really, really an important issue. Related to that, we also see that in split systems, there is a lack of pedagogy for the 2 to 5 year olds. When they are 5 year olds, it's really a preparation to primary school. And when they are babies, when they are or young toddlers, there is also a clear concept on what are the needs of the child and how we should organize the childcare and what quality could be, what concept of pedagogical quality. But for the 2 to 5 year olds, there is really a lack of conceptualization of what educare, the integration of care and education, what it means in daily practice. And we see that the staff of the older children is too much oriented to learning and has a devaluating perspective on care, as if care is hindering the education. And with the youngest children, the educational quality, the challenges that are given to the development of children are undervalued. And you see it in all split systems, that the emotional support of children for the young children is okay, is moderate to good in all countries where we have intensive quality measurements, but the level of educational support is just not good enough. So there is a lack of really conceptualization of an educare pedagogy in the split systems. And then, of course, there's the challenge, the political challenges. It's two different ministries, two different administrative departments, and they don't speak to each other. It's the case in Belgium, it's the case in France, it's the case in Italy. These politicians, they do not sit at the same tables. The administrators, the civil servants, they do not sit at the same tables and they do not speak to each other. And if occasionally they speak to each other, they speak another language. They don't understand each other. So there is really a gap between the two educational systems. So these are what we have inventorized as the major challenges for split systems. Now, what we interestingly see in practice and where we can learn from Finland and from other countries is that in practice, people are taking initiatives to bridge. Even when the policies do not allow it, people in practice are concerned. And we see experiments in the Netherlands, we see experiments in Belgium, we see experiments on the ground in France, where people try to create mixed age groups. And we have very, very, very little research about that. So it is only starting to develop. But the few researches that we have about mixed age groups, where, for instance, children from 2 to 4 or 2 to 5 are together, we see that the quality is not very good. And especially the youngest children are not receiving what they really need in these mixed age groups. So it is not just an issue of putting these children together in this split system to change the system. If we really want to serve the children's need, it's much more complex than that. And it would be helpful, I think, for us to see how it is organized in this integrated system. If there, what are the relations between the different age groups? How does it work? How does a teacher respond to diverse needs? And what are the systemic conditions that are necessary to create a pedagogy of an integrated system?
Okay, well, Canada certainly began with a class-divided system. So kindergarten, when I was growing up, was a program for middle-class and upper middle-class children whose parents wanted them to get a little early start. And it was very much based on the broader principles of a combining of play and learning. And then you had childcare, daycare for working class women who had to work and put their children into care. Now that's changed since the 1960s at least. So kindergarten has moved into the school system, initially for 5-year-olds and now increasingly for 4-year-olds. I think, however, it's come at a time, Michelle, when there's been much more consciousness about avoiding schoolification. So that I know in Ontario, when they went introduced all day kindergarten for children in grade four, 4 year olds and 5 year olds, it included not just a teacher, but also a specialist in early childhood learning and care. So that there was an idea that you would try and have a different culture from basic school culture, even if the children were in the same building. In addition, almost across the country, now childcare and kindergarten are under ministries of education. Unfortunately, that hasn't brought about a change. So there still is a split between kindergarten, which is now sort of free for all, part of the public system, et cetera, although it's not usually compulsory, and childcare, where parents, childcare is still viewed as something for working mothers. Parents pay for childcare with various levels of demand side subsidies based on income. Staffing qualification, and in fact, the cost of childcare in cities like Toronto is just stunning. I don't know how most families could afford it, especially for very young children. Staffing qualifications vary significantly, and wages for childcare staff are exactly as you suggest, Michelle, are low, as well as the sort of opportunities for progression in their careers. One province, Quebec, stands out in terms of offering at least a flat rate childcare of $8.35 a day, irrespective of a child's age. So that's one break. But that, in other ways, Quebec hasn't changed at all. And it's still, in fact, it's one of the few provinces which still splits childcare, which is under the Ministry of Families, and kindergarten, which is under the Ministry of Education. So movements occurred in Canada, but only partway, and there's still a long way to go.
Thank you. So next, we are going to talk about the home care allowance, which has for many decades been quite an important part of the childcare policy in Finland. It's very popular. Families can choose, so the freedom of choice is very important in Finnish family policy, and families either choose this home care allowance, which is a flat rate cash for care benefits, or they choose that their child attends public early childhood education and care, or publicly supported ECEC. So they have this choice, and 4 in 5 families actually use the home care allowance, at least for some months. Not necessarily until the child is 3 years old, but anyway, for some months after parental leave. So this is the national policy, but then there is also local variation, so that many municipalities have a supplement to the home care allowance. And this supplement means that the family gets more money if the child is in home care. But there can be different conditions to receive the supplement. For example, the municipality may require that the parents themselves, one of the parents, takes care of the child, not a relative or some other person. And also, there can be a condition that all children in the family who are preschool age must be in home care. So not only the one who is under 3 who is receiving the benefit, but also the other siblings who can then be like 4-year-olds or 5 or even 6. So they are not allowed to attend early childhood education and care in some municipalities. So there is a local variation added to the national statutory policy. So what is your view on the home care allowance? On the one hand, we often talk about it from the viewpoint of gender equality, but also there is a child perspective to it. So I would turn to Jorma first to talk about this.
Yes, thank you. To begin with, Finland has a very special historical tradition, at least compared to Canada and Belgium. The idea that education does not belong to children's life. So in Finland, children have started their education, their school late, at the age of 7, which is rare in Europe, at least. And the younger ones, so they need care that was provided by the social welfare sector and was very much promoted for under threes as a Scandinavian new idea in 1960s and 70s. And actually the participation in daycare for under threes was very high in Finland. So this problem of low participation has somehow come out later when we have also joined the idea that maybe early education is something important for children, and maybe even kids at the age of 3 or so they could benefit of education. This home care allowance means financial support for care at home after the parental leave ends, after 9 months of age until the age of 3. It was used by 41% of the carers of under threes last year, and 8% of the receivers were men, so 92% were women. The alternatives for under threes are most often public daycare. 1/3 of those small children go to public daycare, and perhaps around 10% go to private, publicly subsidized daycare, which becomes more common for those who are over threes. Thus, what this means is that some kind of subsidized care is always universally available in Finland. You get either education or care or money to somehow organize care by yourself. And the last one is called home care allowance. Home care allowance is not common in the world, especially not for over threes. And it's opposed by many politicians, internationally especially. So why did Finland start this? Well, we should start with the population issue that was very important in the Finnish history after the unhappy war with Soviet Union. So the low birth rate was seen as a danger for the existence of Finnish state and nation, and there were also when the daycare was promoted in Finland in 1970s, so there were practical problems in arranging daycare. We have to understand that what's typical for Finland is low population density compared to any other Western countries and fragmented settlement. So there was some cultural distance also from the mainstream among those people living in the countryside, far away from the capital and the centers, and far away from the modern jobs at the industry and services. So there was also a long political play where when workers got something, so farmers got also something, and this home care allowance was seen as kind of subsidy to families living in small farms. They were very important for the politically most influential center party. So support to all children was also a core issue in the Finnish universal welfare state model, so that everybody belongs to the nation, everybody is supported, everybody is protected by the state. Today, why does this get political support even today? I would say that the reasons are different than what they were in the 1980s. For most parents now, children are more valuable than they have ever been. Parents want to be present and to take part in their kids' development. Of course, there are problems with home care allowance. For instance, parents in marginality. So when parents who are poor, who have illnesses, who use drugs, who have unhappy relationships, when they don't use public daycare for their small kids, so this means that that it certainly is a rather problematic alternative for the kids. There are also parents who lack the social skills, who have difficulties in teaching language for their children, and who stay long out of the labor market because of making kids and taking home care allowance one time after another. So this means that that those families have also problems with meeting the needs of children regarding social skills and creating preconditions for early education. So how could this system be improved without abolishing the home care allowance? One alternative is that we could shorten the distance of the homegrown children to other children and to society. So create prerequisites for early education. We could arrange part-time daycare together with part-time allowance, which is the Norwegian model for small kids under two. Keeping up family daycare, especially in small communities, so that the cultural distance to the daycare centers would not be so long. And also to have more easily accessible activities, like Catholic countries tend to have more than Lutheran countries like Finland. So different kinds of part-time arrangements, clubs and play schools by local voluntary associations. However, in spite of all this, will always be few if alone with the Russians. Thanks.
Thank you, Jorma. And Rianne and Michelle, do you want to comment on this Finnish peculiarity, home care allowance?
It is indeed a particular, a very particular system. And for me, it is difficult to understand and to reflect upon, because there are two, from the family's point of view, there are two conflicting things that I cannot really figure out if I am correct, and please correct me if I'm wrong. There is quite a tradition within the feminist literature about gender inequalities that wish to value the unpaid work, the unpaid care work that is much more taken up by women than by men. And you could consider the home care allowance as a way of doing so, as a way of societally valuing and paying for caring work that is very often done by women and very, in many countries, remains unpaid. So you could advocate for a home care allowance from a feminist perspective. Yet at the same time, we see that the effect of the home care allowance does increase the inequality on the labor market. So from a feminist perspective, you could also criticize the home care allowance. So I'm a bit puzzled about that. That is one aspect. And then, of course, what I also see is that this language of choice, of free choice, it is very much a neoliberal language today. I mean, I understand from what we had just heard from Jorma, it has a quite different history, and it is also related to farmers' families. But in the actual society of today, 2020, 2021, the language of choice, not every parent has the same conditions to choose or has the same choices, but the language of choice includes that parents need to be like valued as I would say entrepreneurs of the life of their children, taking the right decisions. And so it individualizes the responsibility of the education for parents. If your child is not successful, then it's the fault of parents. And so this is, I think, an important aspect of this home care allowance, and more generally of the individualization of educational responsibilities. I think in all societies, historically as well as contemporary, there has always been partly a private and a public responsibility of the education, and how the private and the public is conceived of shifts from country to country, but also from historical period to historical period. And today, this home child care allowance seems to me also a possible shift in this balance between the private and public responsibility, going more towards divided responsibility rather than a shared responsibility. That would be a concern I have, but I would, of course, be very interested in how you, who have experience with that system in Finland, how you would react to these reflections.
Yes, the feminist perspective is very interesting, and I think in Finland, feminist perspective has mainly been quite critical against towards the home care allowance, because it is related to a weaker position in the labor market for women, and it is reproducing that weak position, whereas home care allowance is mainly seen as something very valuable by more conservative political parties and those who criticize feminists. So there is not really, maybe there is a small group of feminists who think also that it is a right of, it is good to have some compensation for care work, but that is not so common in Finland. Rianne, what would you like to say about the home care allowance?
Perhaps very briefly, although I could say that in terms of universality, in the period when the norm was the male breadwinner, Canada had a universal family allowance, and that went to the mother. And in the 1980s, that was eliminated in terms of more targeted spending, and the focus became much more putting funding into childcare for the working mother. And we were making a lot of progress toward that until 2006, when we had a change of government and elected a conservative government, and they withdrew from the agreements with the provinces, which they were allowed to do, which would have funded more childcare, and instead introduced what they called a universal childcare benefit. It wasn't, in fact, having to do with childcare. It wouldn't have covered a week's worth of cost for childcare, but it had that kind of window dressing. But it was popular with families because they do need support often with when they have young children. There are all kinds of expenses. So what's happened is instead of eliminating it, it's become more generous under the Liberal government, but not viewed as a substitute for childcare. That's one piece. The second piece is I did check into, there was one province, the Texas of Canada, Alberta, more conservative in a lot of respects. It had a stay-at-home child care subsidy and a kin care subsidy, which would allow you to pay a family member to provide child care. But both of these were recently abolished because only 1% of the population were using them.
Yes, thank you. So as Jorma said, the use of home care allowance is very much linked to social class questions and the position in the labor market, a more precarious position, especially of women. And our next topic is also very much related to social class, which is the topic is marketization of early childhood education, and Marit will introduce this theme.
So in the Finnish early childhood education and care, there has been a major change, I would say, in the last 10 years, about 10 years or a little more. So before that, our early childhood education and care services were very much produced and provided by the municipality. So we have municipal daycare centers and family daycare. But after especially the legislation regarding vouchers for public services changed, if I remember right, 2009, the number of private early childhood education and care, and especially center-based early childhood education and care, has increased. So, this has happened with a compensation or with the public money. So, municipalities in particular are supporting the use of private services either through vouchers or by giving vouchers to families, or then by paying a municipal supplement to the private daycare allowance, which is paid by the social insurance institution in Finland. And this has also created increasingly discussion since now almost 20%, not quite 20%, but between 15 and 20% of children are in private early childhood education. So of those children who participate in early childhood education and care altogether. What do you think of such development, are there some issues or concerns that we should consider?
I think it is quite a worrying evolution, not only in Finland, but even not only in Europe. It is a worldwide evolution, the marketization and privatization of early childhood education in general and of childcare for the youngest children in particular. We see it in many countries. It started historically. It was always very important in countries with a more liberal welfare state, and these are very often English-speaking countries. I mentioned, for instance, Australia, England, the United States of America. But today we see that it is a global trend, and that also countries, including the Scandinavian countries that had a long tradition of early childhood education as a state responsibility, are now increasingly privatizing. I mentioned, for instance, France. It's interesting to see that only 10 years ago, there was this very good, well-documented book of Eva Lloyd and Helen Penn about childcare markets. And they mentioned France as an example that resisted the tendency to marketization because of their decennia-long tradition of state childcare. It's interesting to see that in France over the last years, half of the new places are private places and are commercial places. So there's hardly any country in the world anymore where this issue is not taking place. What I think is particularly remarkable is that the political arguments for the privatization, they are very much the same in different countries. They say that the market will provide a good equilibrium between quality and costs because of the competition, and it will create places where the need is high, and that And that parents will make good decisive choices and will compare quality and prices, and that will lead to a good balance between price and quality. And the remarkable thing is that all the evidence, whether it is in Asia, whether it is in the US, whether it is in Europe, all the studies that have done so have proven that these assumptions are not true, that these assumptions are false. And still the political argument does not change, despite all the evidence. So there is something remarkable at stake here. I mentioned, for instance, studies from California, from some provinces in Canada, from the Netherlands, that showed that the shift from supply-side funding to demand-side funding, which is one of the aspects of privatization, has led to worse working conditions for the staff. In the Netherlands, there's clear indication that it has led to less satisfaction and to higher inequalities of enrollment. That is also the case in Hong Kong, when the subsidy went more to private organizations. That it has also not increased quality through competitions, but led to lower quality overall. That has been documented in the Netherlands, it has been documented in California, it has been documented in some Canadian provinces. So what is strange is that all the evidence points in the other way, and still the arguments stay the same. So I think the argumentation to privatize early childhood education is an ideological argumentation, an ideological argumentation that is related to the neoliberal welfare state, wherein the economic is going in all directions, and the economic argumentation, which is an ideological rather than a rational, is presented as rational to us, but it is highly ideological. And I think it's very important that the educational community contests this ideology and puts against this ideology an ideology of shared values, of democratic values, wherein education in general and early childhood education in particular, as part of the educational system, has to be considered as a common good that must be in the hands of the democratically elected communities rather than of private institutions.
I'm going to be Michelle's echo again. In a sense, childcare in Canada, as opposed to kindergarten, is organized as a market throughout because parents, for the most part, carry the major cost. Many, therefore, can't afford regulated childcare, even if there are spaces available. Systems based like ours, which are based on subsidy, demand-side subsidies, as opposed to operating costs, just can't close the gap for many middle-income families as well as low-income families. In many provinces, too, in Canada, for-profit childcare is the dominant form of auspice. As much as 70% in our easternmost province of Newfoundland and Labrador, high throughout the whole of the Atlantic provinces, and only in Ontario, Quebec, and Manitoba is non-profit childcare the dominant one. It's not publicly, by the way. We have very, very little publicly provided childcare, the alternative to private childcare. Okay, Canada is also, I found out, is also home to one of the largest childcare multinational corporations called Busy Bees. Ironically, the majority shareholders are the Ontario Teachers' Pension Fund, which is really astonishing. Busy Bees owns centers in the UK, Ireland, Australia, Singapore, Malaysia, and China. And a new book just out by Peter Moss and his colleague Robert Holmes, which nicely picks up on the point that Michelle was making about neoliberalization, points out that not only do you have a growth of for-profit provision, but you also have a growth of a whole industry around that, providing sort of services for such a private childcare, like financial management, insurance, and training, and so on. I will just conclude by saying this kind of system is time and time again shown that it results in unequal access with those who can stand to benefit most from early learning and childcare, least able to access quality care, low pay and limited career possibilities for staff. In Canada, it's resulted in childcare deserts, not only in northern and rural communities, but also in less well-off parts of cities. Proponents argue that creating a market for childcare increases choice, Yeah, but choice for whom? And just how easy is it for the consumer to make informed decisions?
Thank you, Michelle and Rian. Jorma, how do you see the Finnish development in early childhood education regarding marketization?
Yeah, it's a big problem. It's really a big problem because of having this profit-making business coming to care. So I'm wondering that where are the limits? Are we someday producing babies by profit-making organizations? Or is there some limit that can't be overcome? The basic problem with profit-making organizations is that they are always wanting more. Nothing is enough when you are in banking or in financing business. So you know that you manage in the competition only if you make more money than the others do. And that's why, so there is no reasonable interest rate that should be acceptable and could somehow fit the other purposes that public services have. And it's basically, it's possible for governments to set such limits. But when politics and business are so strongly bound together as they are in Western countries, so it seems to be difficult even for reasonable governments to somehow find acceptable coexistence between profit-making businesses and necessary services for people, who, especially those who have difficulties to defend themselves and who have only a small voice in politics.
Thank you, Jorma. But I think that now we can go back more to families and family life and family leave systems, which we already kind of touched upon, and to our final topic, which will be introduced by Johan.
Yes, let's go to the chronological starting point of childcare responsibilities and childcare policies also. So let's talk about who takes care of babies, the young, very young children. So when people become parents, it is parental leave that is the first policy that supports them in the reconciliation of childcare responsibilities and paid employment. And in Finland, the parental leave scheme is about 10 to 11 months long, and there is an income-related benefit, which is available for both mothers and fathers. But only 10% of leave has been taken by fathers. And that is one of the main reasons, this gender inequality and imbalance in sharing childcare responsibilities, that the Finnish government has introduced a parental leave reform this year. The reform, first of all, it increases the length of the income-related parental leave and also divides it more equally between parents. So the proposal comprises of two different elements. There's pregnancy leave for the mother before birth, about 6.5 weeks. And then there is two quotas of parental leave. So a quota for each parent, which is about 6.5 months long. However, of this long quota, each parent can transfer 2.5 months to the other parent. And if you are a single parent, you can use both quotas. So the parental leave period would increase, get longer by about 3 months. And the main target is to increase gender equality in childcare responsibilities, which then is linked to labor market position, of course, and many other things as well. But how about the child's perspective? How do you consider this reform from, on the one hand, gender equality, and on the other hand, equality between children? Maybe Jorma can say something about this first.
Okay. For me, this is much more than an equality issue. It's an issue of male culture, men's role in the world, men taking part in care of small babies means for me much more than equality in the labor market or sharing some duties. I think that coming closer to the essentials of life in whichever age of another person, so is somehow fundamental for us in learning to be human beings. And this tradition of men avoiding so much of the common life together with small children is a beginning or is a part of such a human career that does not fit the times we are living, the problems we are involved with, and the road where our culture should be moving towards. So I think that the more men share their time with babies, it influences their lives, future life, politics, and relationship to other human beings so deeply that this is exactly the place where a change should be done. And when in Finland we have the problem that that especially young men, young fathers are working long hours because of paying for the housing loans and for making progress in their work careers. So this is particularly important just here. So I strongly support very equal sharing of care leaves and longer care leaves for men.
Thank you, Jorma. But how about in Canada and Belgium? Do you have a father's quota of parental leave, or is there any discussion of what that kind of quota would mean?
First, let me say that I completely agree with Jorma that parental leave, shared parental leave is both, I would say, important for gender equality, but it's also really important for the child and for the father. Now in Canada, we have an interesting experiment going on in the sense that we have one system in the province of Quebec, the French province of Quebec, just as we have with childcare, and one system in the rest of Canada. From the beginning in the 1990s, Quebec offered a clear incentive for fathers to take their share, offering a certain portion of the daddy leave reserved for the father only, and offered at a much higher rate than is offered in the rest of Canada. The rest of Canada, until recently, there was no particular allocation only for fathers, and the rate of, although one has been introduced in the last year, allowing for, well, I won't get into the details, but up to 5 weeks for the father, the rate that it's offered at is incredibly low, a 55% of income replacement at best. So you see between the two places, in Quebec, four out of five fathers take their share of parental leave. In the rest of Canada, up until now at least, one in five. So that's the first part of what I want to say. But the second part, I think, is a little broader. There are also different conditions of access. In Quebec, having simply earned $2,000 or more over the last year, which is equivalent to 160 hours at the minimum wage, makes you eligible. In the rest of Canada, 600 hours was required. As a result, 89% of mothers in Quebec qualify for parental leave versus 35% in the rest of Canada. And this becomes really important because fathers can't get access, or the other partner, actually, we're very progressive, it's not just fathers, but the other partner in a family can't get access to their share of parental leave unless the mother qualifies. So that's a big gap, and it points to something which has been happening. I don't know as much about Finland's labor market, but in many other places where there's been a tremendous growth in what we call non-standard employment. Now, one of the nice things that's happened is that under COVID, the federal government has said, well, we should reduce the qualification period to only 120 hours of insured earnings. And what my colleague, again, Andrea Doucette and others have said, this suggests the move to where we should be going to what they call a mixed benefits approach, which consists of employment-related social insurance, parental leave, and a citizenship entitlement for those who don't make it under the social insurance rules. And Peter Moss and his colleague put it even more simply that we have to have not just the right to leave from work for care, but also the right to care. And this is becoming all the more important with the spread of non-standard forms of employment.
I'm not going to add much to that because I am not a parental leave specialist. It's really not my field of expertise. And second, I entirely agree with what Jorma said. I think it's very much important for the life of children as well as for the harmonious life of families that we move towards more equal balances in parental leave. And also for the society as a whole, we see that in many, many aspects, we have increased needs for care. It's true for young children, but it's also true for elderly people. And we have, I think the pandemic, the COVID pandemic has showed how important care workers are. And if we will not have more men who will enroll in care work, we will just not be able to cover the care needs of the future. And so it's important that we raise our children and the next generations of children in environments, in societal environments in which care is valued both by women and by men. So there is really a societal issue there. I will not comment more on that because in Belgium we do not have a quota system. We have an extremely unequal and we are at the low end of Europe when it is about parental leave, both for mothers and fathers, but also at the low end for the inequality between the genders in parental leave. So we are one of the worst examples.
Thank you to all of you. I think that this last topic, in a way, and the last comment nicely kind of put together these two topics we have discussed: childcare and childcare in the family, and early childhood education and care, and in a way this idea that and thinking that if we don't share care in the family, then it might be that in the future, and in a way, already nowadays, at least in Finland, so the gender kind of division or representation, I mean, in early childhood education is very, very uneven. So it's mostly women. But I think it is time to end this discussion, and I want to say thank you to all of you for your time, for your comments, for your participation in this panel. Thank you.